You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Isn't it incredible in Wisconsin? You know, you've got this Scott Walker recall coming up, but there's also a Democratic primary for who's going to run against him if he gets recalled. And the Republicans have people who have re-registered as Democrats, fake Democrats, so that they can run in the Democratic primary to try and screw up the thing, the system. These people don't believe in democracy. They don't believe in democratic process. I'm talking small d democracy. They don't believe in democratic processes. They don't even believe in a republic. What they believe in is power. Pure and simple. Power. Sigmund Freud would have an absolute, total field day examining today's Republican Party. You know, Freud had this idea. He went through a whole series of different ways of developing psychology. He actually used hypnosis up until the 1890s. And then a novel called Trilby was published, which gave hypnosis a bad name, shall we say. And so he started using cocaine, and that didn't work out so well. And then he got into the Oedipus and electric complex and all this stuff. But in the middle of all this, he came up with some pretty good ideas, actually. A few, you know, his concept of the ego and the id and the superego and all those things. But he also had this thing called projection, psychological projection, and a reaction formation projection. Projection is basically when someone projects onto other people the beliefs that they themselves hold or the actions that they themselves would carry out but are in denial about. For example, if someone's a habitual liar, they hide it by accusing others around them of lying. And it sure looks like Mitt Romney is guilty of this very particular sort of psychological projection. After all, one of the central messages of his campaign is how awful Obamacare is. Now, just think about that for a minute. Mitt Romney was the first governor in the history of the United States to enact Romneycare, which is basically Obamacare on the state level. He was governor of Massachusetts. And while the issue of health care is the most obvious form of projection by Mitt Romney, there are several others. Like just last week, Mitt Romney said it's actually President Obama who's waging a war on women, not Republicans. Or a few weeks back when Mitt Romney said that it's President Obama who's destroying Medicare, not Republicans. This is, you know, and in fact, this is coming from the same guy who called multimillionaire Republican Congressman Paul Ryan's budget that actually does end Medicare as we know it marvelous. Here's just a couple of clips. I believe it's Obama.gov or whatever it is, the Obama website. They've juxtaposed Romney and Obama, Romney versus reality. Here's clip number 14, Jacob.
The president has pledged to transform America, and he spent the last 4 years laying the foundation for a new government-centered society.
I have never been somebody who believes that government can or should try to solve every problem.
Okay, so there's one. Here's another one.
He saw free enterprise as the villain and government as a solution.
I believe deeply that the free market is the greatest force for economic progress in human history.
See, I don't even have to yell liar when Mitt Romney says these things. He's saying that Obama said such and such. And no, in fact, these are all Obama statements from before Romney told these lies. Here's another one.
When you attack business and you vilify success, you're going to have less business and less success.
I know that the true engine of job creation in this country is the private sector, not Washington.
There you go. Here's another one.
Tax increases not only become a necessity, but also a desired tool for social justice.
I've cut taxes for small business owners 17 times over the last 3 years.
Yeah. And one more.
Government spending always increases because, well, why not?
As president, I've eliminated dozens of programs that weren't working and put annual domestic spending on a path to become the smallest share of the economy since Dwight Eisenhower held this office.
And another one.
If we become one of those societies that attacks success, one outcome is certain. There'll be a lot less success.
In this country, broad-based prosperity has never trickled down from the success of a wealthy few. It has always come from the success of a strong and growing middle class.
You know, it's like lied truth. Mitt Romney versus reality. There's still a couple more, aren't there, Jacob? One more. Okay, here you go.
We'll stop the days of apologizing for success at home and never again apologize for America abroad.
I have no doubt that we will continue our long and prosperous journey as the greatest nation on earth. Thank you. God bless you. God bless the United States of America.
So, you know, here's Mitt Romney versus reality. Now, even on non-policy issues, Romney seems to be projecting himself on President Obama. For example, he went off on a rant a couple days ago about how out of touch the president is because he went to Harvard. He said, oh, maybe he spent too much time at Harvard. Romney went to Harvard. In fact, he was there a year longer than President Obama. So you've got the clip of this? Okay, here you go.
We have a president who I think is a nice guy, but he spent too much time at Harvard, perhaps.
Yeah, right. But Romney went to Harvard longer than Obama did. So what's going on? Does Mitt Romney and the Republican messaging team behind him, do they all really suffer from Freudian psychological projection? Are they mentally ill? Or is there something else going on here? Think about this for a second. We're on the verge of a $2 or $3 billion presidential election that is going to determine how trillions of dollars in America are distributed, whether it's government purchases or government setting the rules for business. Trillions of dollars are at stake. Do you really think that the Republican Party and their guy Mitt Romney are flying by the seat of their pants and lying about the president because they're suffering from some sort of Freudian psychological malady? Or do you think that this is part of a strategy? And that would be the strategy I've been talking about on this show for the last few weeks, which is this. The only way Republicans can win elections is by lying. I think it's a very specific strategy. It has to be a strategy. The stakes are too high for this just to be an accident or an issue of mental illness. You know, Republicans tried this strategy against Bill Clinton, but Clinton was ready for it. Back in 1992, the Bill Clinton campaign launched the Rapid Response War Room, which was based on rapid response. Immediately, in that same day, in that same news cycle, jumping on whatever lie or half-truth the George Herbert Walker Bush campaign threw at Bill Clinton, and responding to it in the media in the same day, in that same news cycle, thus stopping the lie dead in its tracks. It worked. Clinton won election that year. He did it again 4 years later, and he won re-election doing the same thing. But in 2004, John Kerry said, oh, we don't need to do that. We'll trust the voters to be able to sort out lies from the truth. And so they ignored the lies that were being pushed by Karl Rove and organizations like the Swift Boat Veterans for Truth. And what happened? The lies embedded themselves in the national dialogue. They were picked up by the mainstream news, and they ended up costing Kerry the election. Similarly, Al Gore ignored the lies about him saying that he invented the Internet and all that kind of stuff. Today, the Republicans are not even trying to disguise their lies. They're openly and enthusiastically responding to truth with bald-faced lies. In fact, it's so blatant, you might confuse the strategy with an actual mental illness, as I mentioned earlier, but it's not a mental illness. Unless you consider the sociopathic element of being a bald-faced liar. The point is, Republicans lie because they can get away with it. Have you ever seen a Republican challenged on a lie on corporate media, on Meet the Press or Face the Nation? Neither have I. It's why they keep coming back on these shows. And they'll continue to do this. They'll continue to get away with it as long as no one calls them out as liars. Not only that, with billions of dollars behind them, right now they're making TV ads, websites, and launching bus tours to promote these and other lies to even more Americans. President Obama isn't waging a war on women. Mitt Romney and the Republicans are. President Obama isn't trying to end Medicare as we know it. Mitt Romney and the Republicans are. Let's not get duped by Republican lies again. Tell your friends, your family, and your coworkers what's going on.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Because if we don't, then Mitt Romney will win the presidency, and he'll do it because throughout his career he was willing to lie with no shame.
Smiling faces sometimes, they don't tell the truth. Smiling faces.
Welcome back, Occupying the Media, 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. Tom Hartman here with you, going on our ninth year. And, Talkers Magazine just came out with their Heavy 100 top talk show hosts. And really cool news. For the last 3 years, I've been either number eight. I was number 10 for a year, and then for the last 2 years, I was number eight. And everybody ahead of me in the line was a right winger. And this year, Ed Schultz is number four. Good on you, Ed. Congratulations. And I'm number eight again. So we're both in the top 10. And everybody else, of course, you know, Hannity, Limbaugh, all the usual suspects of the right wingers. But progressive talk radio is really getting a toehold. It's really more than a toehold. Pretty solid stuff. To, you know, have two out of 10 of the top 10 talk shows in America be progressive talk shows. I'm very pleased and honored by it, and I think it's a good thing for the business. Okay, the American Legislative Exchange Council, ALEC. You know, there's been this pressure campaign. We've done no shortage of shows on this, on ALEC here on this show. About, you know, in fact, I think Lee Fong, when he was doing the initial research, he was a regular on our TV show on RT. By the way, you know, we independently produce our show that is carried on RT. And it used to be, I think it was the only show on RT that wasn't owned and produced by RT. We license it to them. We also license it to Free Speech TV that carries it into 55 million homes nationwide. Julian Assange has produced an independent program. He owns it. He controls the production content. And he's distributing it through RT also. We're in over 100 countries, a half a billion homes. And his first show was today. And he interviewed Nasrallah, the head guy of Hezbollah, which has a lot of people going, why is he doing that? On the other hand, it's a really interesting interview. And I think sometimes it's interesting. It's important, frankly, for us to be listening to dissenting voices. But anyhow, back to Lee Fong. Lee Fong was a regular on our show, and still is. In fact, he was on day before yesterday. I think he's going to be on tonight. And ALEC has said, okay, we're going to stop pushing these shoot first, you know, stand your ground, shoot first laws, and we're going to stop pushing the you can't vote if you're an old person law, if you're on Social Security, if you don't drive a car anymore. We're going to stop pushing those laws, and we're going to focus on economic issues. Like union busting. That's great. And ending the estate tax so that the Koch brothers can, you know, I call it the Paris Hilton tax, right? Let's do away with the Paris Hilton tax. Let's do away altogether with capital gains taxes. You know, the only reason that Mitt Romney pays 15% is because all his income is capital gains and or variations thereof, you know, that fall into that 15% maximum tax bracket. And this is why he's paying 13.9% because he's giving, you know, he gives a fair 10% ties to the church, all that kind of thing. So he ends up paying less than 15% in taxes. Well, under the Koch brothers' ALEC proposals, Mitt Romney would pay nothing. Repeal the capital gains tax.
It's double taxation, you know.
Like, you know, I should be able to walk into 7-Eleven and say, I'll take that candy bar. By the way, don't charge me taxes on it because I already paid income tax when I got this money. And so if you charge me sales tax, that's double taxation. That would be wrong. People are crazy. They want to privatize more public lands. This is part of ALEC's agenda. They're going to propose model legislation to do that. Or if they haven't already, they're proposing model legislation. These are laws that will go into all the states. Repeal minimum wage laws. Fight efforts to stop climate change, man-made climate change.
Oh, we can't. You can't tell the Koch brothers that they can't pump that carbon dioxide into the atmosphere out of the Koch oil industries. You know, come on, give me a break. And mercury's.
You know, get enough of it, you can start making thermometers. Come on. They want to do away with laws that require employers to offer paid sick days. That's pretty crazy. And one of the most toxic things that they want to do is they want to pass legislation in every state that requires a supermajority, a two-thirds majority, in order to raise taxes. So basically you end up with a situation like we had in Oregon when I lived there, where it was impossible to raise taxes, and at the end of every legislative session, if there was any money left over in the budget, like, you know, there's, you want your state to have a rainy day fund, you know. Next year might not be as good economically as this year. The collections, tax collections might not be as good, or you might be hit by a natural disaster. It would be more likely a flood in Oregon, or, you know, down in the Gulf Coast. It could be a hurricane or a tornado in Nebraska or Tennessee or something. But whatever it is. But no, the right-wingers, you know, again, this kind of ALEC type sponsored legislation, they passed this thing called the kicker law, which says that not only can't you raise taxes without a supermajority, but if there's any money left over at the state at the end of the year, you have to write checks and send that money back to the people in the state. Now, for most taxpayers in Oregon, that means you get like a $20 check. But for a few people, you know, like the billionaires, Phil Knight owns Nike, lives in Oregon, although he's not the only one. I mean, there's some very, very wealthy people in that state. They're getting back like big checks. And the state doesn't, and it's not like they're behind it. I mean, this is the right-wing ideology. And the state, as a consequence of that, can't have a rainy days law. So ALEC is going to focus its attention on this. And we're supposed to be gratified or pleased, I suppose, about that. No more stand your ground, shoot first laws. Color me not gratified.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
If anything, it's like they're going to refocus on being even more toxic to democracy in a republic and more in favor of fascism, a corporate takeover.
Rocket Man, burning on the fuse out of hell alone.
The Rocket Man, yes. We had the, here in Washington, D.C., the space shuttle flew over the town this morning as they brought it down to put in the, I believe it's going in the Air and Space Museum, which is part of the Smithsonian. Smithsonian is like 34, as I recall, different buildings all around this town. I've been in probably 8 or 10 of them. One of my books, it's called Think Fast, The ADD Experience, was actually inducted into the Smithsonian. This was back in the 80s. I was running a forum on CompuServe, the ADD forum, and we compiled a bunch of content out of the forum, including an article that I wrote and a bunch of other people. And Dave DeBroncard and me and a couple of other people edited this thing and attached a CD to it that had all the content from the forum on it. And Underwood Books published it, and it won an award that year as the I forget the title of the award. It was something like, you know, leading contribution to the synthesis of technology and medicine. And it was on display in the Smithsonian for about a year. And I think this must have been like 88. And this was back when CompuServe was the internet. And it's still there. I mean, it's not on display anymore, but it's... one of my books is down in the bowels of the National Archive, or now they have the Smithsonian. It's kind of cool. Anyhow, 866-987-THOM. I got to, you know, Fox News, of course, they did the day of the Hillary Rosen thing. They did all day, you know, nothing but Hillary Rosen. Now, the latest meme coming out of Fox News is that President Obama, you know, you realize there's this war on women from the Republicans. You know, they've got all these policies. The Romney campaign has not said that they will support the Lilly Ledbetter Fair Pay Act. The governor of Wisconsin, Scott Walker, just repealed a law that said that women should get the same pay as men for the same work. And, you know, there's this economic, I mean, setting aside issues of birth control or abortion or anything like that, there's an economic war on women being waged by the Republican Party. And so how does Fox respond to this? Well, today they said Obama's disdain for women came from his Marxist father. That's a twofer. They get to remind people that his dad was a Kenyan. I don't know that he was a Marxist, but he was a Kenyan Muslim. And that they get to make up this lie about how he's got a disdain for women. The war on women? No, 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 no. It's not something the Republicans are doing. It's something Obama's doing. Right. K Ken in Round Lake, Illinois. Hey, Ken, what's on your mind today?
I had a question about Mitt Romney and gas prices. Mitt Romney sent thousands of jobs to China, India, and these other countries, boosting their middle class, which is they're using more oil now. And if that's the case, he helped raise gas prices. And if that is right, how come nobody talks about it?
Well, your logic, your 1-2-3 logic has something going for it. I mean, I wouldn't totally discount it. I don't think that you could say that Mitt Romney is single-handedly responsible for outsourcing all the jobs that went out of America, although he did outsource a lot of jobs. You're absolutely right on that. Number two, though, here's the interesting thing. The supplies of oil around the world right now are at record highs, but consumption is not. And in the United States, use the U.S. as an example, our gasoline supplies are higher than they've ever been. And our demand for gasoline is lower than it was in 1997 when gasoline was $1.90 a gallon. And so our high gas prices are not the function of supply and demand. They're not the function of Romney offshoring jobs or all those people, you know, working in China needing to drive to work. They are pure and simple the product of either oil companies holding gasoline off the U.S. market by exporting it. Massive amounts of gasoline are being exported from the United States. It is our number one manufactured product export. The number one thing the United States exports right now is gasoline. Never been that way. Well, actually, it was that way back in the 70s. But since the 70s, it has never been that way. So number one, they export all this surplus gasoline to drive down supplies and drive up prices. And number two, you've got speculators on Wall Street taking a lot of it out of the futures market by buying, you know, by speculating in gasoline futures. So that's the real problem, and that ties into Mitt Romney by virtue of the fact that 91% of all of Wall Street's money so far in this election cycle has gone to Republicans, and of that, 73% of it has all gone to Mitt Romney. So Mitt Romney is the Wall Street candidate. Wall Street is bringing you the high gas prices, not to mention the oil companies, and the oil companies, of course, are that's Mitt Romney's, he's their guy too. Gary in Granite City, Illinois. Hey, Gary, what's up?
Hey, Tom, it's a privilege again, the second time I've called in. I had a comment on the the Hillary Rosen thing mm-hmm. she said about Ann Romney.
Yeah.
You know, I think she apologized way too soon.
And way too much.
I think she's spot on. I mean, Ann Romney raised 5 kids. I bet she had a half a dozen servants to help with that. You know, probably a nanny, probably a tutor for the kids so she wouldn't help with her homework, probably a maid to clean up, probably a cook to cook, and probably an errand girl to go out and get all the stuff she needed, you know. And
not to mention the people who mow the lawn and keep the house up. I mean, Mitt Romney himself got called out on having those guys be illegal aliens, and he said to the guy who ran the company that he'd hired to do all his lawn work, you know, get the illegals out of here. I'm running for president, for goodness sakes. Remember that?
I mean, I would, Tom, go on national TV and say Ann Romney never did a day of work in her life. And I darn well tell you, I wouldn't apologize for it.
Yeah.
I would demand to see proof. You know what I mean?
Well, the problem is that the faux outrage, this phony outrage, this hysteria that the right can gin up about pretty much anything that they want is, you know, while it may not have any basis in fact and it's not solid, Fox and all the right-wing talk radio is, and their ability to push things into the mainstream so it gets covered by the big networks is so powerful, is so real.
Well, they own broadcasting, Tom.
Of course, my point, that the strategic decision made by the Democratic Party is, let's just get this one behind us because we need to get on a roll. We need to change the topic to the Romney plan versus the Buffett plan, you know, and so that's what they were doing. Gary, thanks for the call. I mean, you're well said, and I totally agree with you, but there is a technique to political strategy that is being played out. Mike in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. Mike, what's up?
Hi. Well, they're not playing it out in Pennsylvania, Tom. I can tell you that right now. I'm a truck driver. I was in a truck stop last night watching TV. Every half hour on the hour, Mitt Romney commercials. Not one time did I see a commercial for President Obama, any Democrats. You know, Pennsylvania is a battleground state.
Yep.
I mean, it's a battleground state. They need to start advertising. This guy is going to swamp the airs you know, swamp the airwaves. And when it comes time to vote, all people are going to remember is how this guy, how Mitt Romney saved this guy's daughter in New York City.
Yeah.
You know, that's what the commercial was about. And, you know, I think what they're doing is they're lying back because President Obama's got such a big lead. But again, one of the headlines on Yahoo.com yesterday was how it's a dead heat now.
Yeah, well, yesterday Romney was up by 2 points. Today Obama's up by 2 or 3 points. You know, it's going to go back and forth. But between now and November is a long, long time. The reason Romney's running those ads in Pennsylvania is because there is a primary coming up, and Santorum is from Pennsylvania. And if Romney fails to beat Santorum in Pennsylvania, especially after Santorum is pulled out of the race, he's got some serious problems.
But the thing is, though, they weren't commercials against Santorum. They were commercials against President Obama.
I know, because they've stopped all the anti-Santorum ads because he's no longer running. But they, you know, he had gone to a bunch of billionaires and said, "Hey, listen, I need a couple million bucks to run ads in Pennsylvania to take down Santorum." They said, "Fine, here's the check. The ads are running." And you know, as you correctly point out, what they will do is they will lay a solid foundation for Romney come November. And I agree with you. Wouldn't it be great if the president and his surrogates had the money to run those kinds of ads in you know, around the country? But right now it's a bit of a challenge. So, you know, all the more reason why this is an election that I think is going to turn. The Republicans are betting it's going to turn on money. I'm betting it's going to turn on shoe leather. But we'll see. Virginia in Portland. Hey, Virginia, what's up? Portland,
hey,
Oregon.
Tom, I heard the Talkers radio list on Ed's show this morning, and I wanted to congratulate you. Ed said that Joe Madison came in at number 10.
Uh-huh.
And if that's true, then three of the top 10 are progressive, which, given the size of the megaphone on the other side and all the money they have, is really impressive. Good for you and good for us who listen.
Yeah, I agree. And I, you know, frankly, I just glanced at it this morning on the web, and I got to number 8, and there was my face, and so I stopped. But if Joe is number 10, I'm going to have to, you know, I'll be looking at it when I get off the air. But that's spectacular. So,
yeah. Now, the reason I called was where you started the program about, are these people premeditated? Is this a policy plan, or are they crazy?
Yeah.
And my answer is, the people in charge on the right, the elected officials and the operatives, the Karl Roves, etc., this is premeditated.
Okay? And they're crazy.
Yeah,
they're sociopaths.
They are crazy. But the thing that's dangerous about all of this is that the choir they're preaching to, the Tea Party, the militias, the extreme edge of the NRA, all of those folks, those are really unhinged people. They're dangerous people. And they're inciting them to all kinds of violence. Rachel Maddow did a program last week about just the massive number of police shootings in the last couple of weeks.
Yeah.
You know this isn't coming
and the police shootings have been going up along with justifiable homicides as these stand-your-ground-shoot-first laws have been passed. Virginia, thank you for the call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
54 minutes past the hour. Back with more here on the Tom Hartman Program right after this opportunity to support our program.
As directions from a genie in a bottle of Jim Beam, and she lies to you. That's when you learn the truth. If you're going through hell, keep on going. Don't slow.
Talk media for the sane among us. Welcome back to the place where despair is not an option. No, we are going to get out there. We are going to get active. We are going to make things happen. Jim in Redford, Michigan. Hey, Jim, what's up?
Well, Tom, it's been a pleasure to listen to you for several years now. Listen, several people have commented about how do we combat the lies of the Republicans.
Yeah.
And we should say that. I suggest that, you wrote a book on cracking the code, I think.
Cracking the Code was the title, and it
was. Right. Well,
the
Republican Party is the party of guile and mendacity, and Romney is their candidate.
Sure.
We should point that out in just exactly those words and define what guile is.
I think most Americans don't know what either guile nor mendacity means. That's the problem.
But that's also an opening to explain what it means.
Why don't we just call them bald-faced liars?
Well, that's a
start. It's a fancy way of saying guile and mendacity.
Okay. And the other another thing I might suggest to you is that the bifurcation of society between the elites and others, we should call them the privileged and the burdened.
Yeah, that's a good one. The privileged and the burdened. The I came up with this morning is I'm going to start referring to wealthy people from this point forward. I mean, the really, really rich, people who make more than a couple of million dollars a year, as the Romney rich.
Sure.
And I wish, I hope that that catches on. Because there's a very small number of Romney rich in the United States. I mean, it's 10,000-20,000. It's not a lot of people who make more than $1 million a year. And particularly who make it sitting, on their butts around the pool waiting for the dividend checks to arrive. There's Mitt Romney, there's Paris Hilton, there's the Waltonaires, there's a few, and they pay very low taxes. And so the Romney rich pay very, very few taxes, and we need to
the money they earn on their money is taxed at a lower rate than the wages that I earn on my labor.
That's right.
There's something wrong about that picture.
That's right, or potentially taxed. I'm guessing, Jim, that you probably pay more than 15% in federal income taxes. So, I mean, a lot of people do.
I don't know, but yeah. I'm just a semi-retired working man.
Oh, okay. So if you're semi-retired, you may not be. But the average working person, I think, is probably paying the neighborhood of 15%. Not necessarily the average, because the average has really shrank since Reagan. I mean, it's just been flat for 30 years at around $26,000 a year. And at that, yeah, I don't think people are even paying 15%. But if you're a working person who's doing a little better, if you're making what the average household income is, $40,000, or if you're making, the low end of the upper end of the middle class, $60,000, $70,000, $80,000, you could easily be paying 15%.
Well, I'm just an old retired truck driver.
Okay, well, good on you, Jim, and I appreciate it.
One other thing. You were talking about the strategy that the Republicans are using. This is something you will appreciate, I know, is that if you were to take the writings of Machiavelli and overlay them with the writings of Joseph Goebbels,
mm-hmm.
you will get where they're coming from. You will find that that's the methods that they're using. They're using propaganda to effectuate their ruthlessness.
I totally agree. And people should read, Goebbels' famous quote is about the big lie. Machiavelli's book is called The Prince, and it's a work worth reading, and it's not that long. It's maybe 50-60 pages. And it's very straightforward. And ironically, it was written when Machiavelli was out of a job. And he wrote this thing as a way of pitching himself as an advisor to the king of Italy. And I don't know if he ever got the job or not. I'm not sure. I don't remember that part of it, but from years ago reading that. Anyhow, Jim, thanks a lot for the call. Steve in Haymarket, Virginia. Hey, Steve, what's up?
Just thinking about this tax situation here.
Yeah.
In other words, let's get to a point where there's called tax security, where you basically have enough money to live out the rest of your life or your kids have enough money.
Mm-hmm.
And the rest of that money, I'm talking like $1 billion, $2 billion, would then either be used to buy 49% of small businesses, or it would go at 1% increments to the government.
So you're talking about taxing wealth rather than income.
Taxing wealth rather than income, because if you've got an active, wealth that is active, then you don't really need to tax it because it's already out there producing things and making jobs. In other words, the mattress analogy of people just putting money under a mattress or buying gold or whatever.
Right. The Scrooge McDuck money bin.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Get it out there. And the other thing is, since we won World War I, do we really need withholding taxes anymore?
Yes.
Put it in my bank as a Christmas club deal, and write three checks on October 15th.
The problem is your bank is making money with that money rather than the federal government making money with that money, first of all. So withholding tax actually reduces all of our taxes because it allows the federal government to use that money immediately. And secondly, with the withholding tax, it's a little more invisible, although a lot of us over the last day or two have written large checks to the IRS, but or small checks, whatever, have had to deal with that. Anyhow, Steve, thanks a lot for the call. Anthony in Grosse Pointe, Michigan. Hey, Anthony, we've got a minute to the break. What's up?
Oh, it's Groseal, Michigan.
Groseal.
Another mouth of, 1 point. last week you had someone saying that donations to your kids are tax-free. $13,000 for you and for your wife each, so it's $26,000 a year. But the main point I wanted to make was I live on this island, which is a very elite island.
Mm-hmm.
And I have people at work. I work at GM. I'm at the boat plant. And people over there said, well, you can't get rich and give our job creators. I go ask them, how many millionaires do you know? Well, I don't know any. I said, I know six. I said, I know six millionaires, multimillionaires, and one's in Europe, the other's in South America, another guy's traveling around the world on his yacht, and that, and I said, the other ones are just having a good time, partying.
Yeah.
I said, and then one guy tells me, he says, you know, I love this idea. He said, for the simple reason, I haven't created a job in almost 20 years.
Yeah.
He says, I enjoy my life.
The job creators are the people who spend money. Because that generates demand. When you're the job creator, Anthony. When you go out in the marketplace,
I know that, and they agree with it.
Yeah, when you go out in the marketplace, and thanks for the call. You go out in the marketplace and you buy something that creates demand. And if you buy enough stuff, some entrepreneur out there is going to say, "Hey, Anthony wants to buy something. I'll make it."
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back to our second hour. Tom Hartman here with you, and Gary Lucas is not on line 12. Oh, she's on Skype. Oh, okay. Great. Hey, Gary. Greetings.
Hey, can you hear me okay, Tom?
I hear you just fine. I didn't see on the call screen software. Gary Lucas is the Managing Director of the Independent Women's Forum, and where on earth is Gary today?
I'm Brussels, Belgium.
Brussels, Belgium. Holy cow. now, there's a hospital center down in Texas, correct me if I'm wrong on this, that has said that if a woman who is 5'5", weighs over 210 pounds, they will not hire her. They're going to discriminate against the obese or against people who are overweight. And their rationale is that it sets a bad example for patients who should not get overweight. And, you know, there's really no good science that suggests that seeing fat people on the one hand or just pumped up people, you know, going to the gym and seeing a trainer who's looks like Arnold Schwarzenegger, used to look anyway, is going to cause any kind of radical change in anybody's behavior. So what's the deal with this?
Yeah, you know, Tom, I think we may agree on this one. This is definitely, I think, you know, you can understand what the hospital's trying to do, but I think it's a really faulty and poor execution of trying to set a good example. And you're absolutely right that I don't think that there's any correlation between the idea of seeing somebody in a staff position or so, someone in the medical field and saying, oh, okay, well, then I'm going to go and, you know, overeat because it must be okay because they're doing it. And then also BMI is a very faulty measure of health. And I do think that fixating on some of these data points can really lead us in the wrong direction. You know, that people can be at different weights and be healthy. People who are really muscular can have a higher BMI. I know that there's been statistics or studies done showing that a lot of football players or top athletes would actually fail some of these BMI tests because they're heavier, because they're stronger.
Right. So, for people who don't know what you're talking about, BMI is body mass index.
Yeah,
and,
exactly.
Right. Okay, and it's a relationship between the mass of your body and the size of your body.
Yeah, and it's become one of those measurements that is, you know, when the government is trying to encourage healthy behavior, they use that as a measurement, not just, you know,
as a guideline.
As a guideline, exactly. Yeah. And even talking about, you know, forcing doctors to talk to kids. And really, I think in some ways, I worry that it's going to stigmatize this. You know, we already have, I think, a real problem where, we've made it so important to not be fat that, that it's a lot of people who are overweight feel really bad about themselves. And I don't think that is actually helping them lead healthier lifestyles. And I worry that this fixation on this number, could cause more problems rather than solve them.
I personally think we just need to stop subsidizing corn and thus get the high fructose corn syrup out of our diet, and we will end up like other countries that don't use high fructose corn syrup and won't have as many fat people or overweight people. But that's just my personal conspiracy theory du jour. Let me get this straight, though, Carrie. You're suggesting that this hospital should not be allowed to discriminate against overweight people?
You know, Tom, I don't want to say aloud, and I think that's one of the things that, you know, I agree with you on the corn thing too. I think that there's a lot of areas of agreement between, you know, a conservative like me and a liberal like you on this one. But I do want to be careful in saying that, you know, particularly on private hospitals, I think they can set their hiring policies. But I think this is a bad one. I don't know that it's, that I think that it should be the government, shouldn't be in the role of dictating all these decisions on hiring. But I really think that this is the kind of thing we should discourage, and I don't think that that it's a good idea what Texas is trying to do. But
so, like, you know, in the Nixon Kennedy debates, famously, the question was asked to both candidates: what should we do about the fact that African Americans are not allowed to eat at lunch counters in the South? And Richard Nixon said, "Well, what I would do is I would get the presidents of the chain stores, the Woolworths and the Walgreens and whatnot of the day, you know, I would get them together in a room and I would try and convince them that it's not the right thing that they're doing by having these discrimination policies. And then they went to John Kennedy, and John Kennedy said, I would send the Justice Department to inform them that they are breaking the law. And that was the principal difference between Nixon and Kennedy in that issue, is that Nixon wanted it to be voluntary. Are you suggesting that discrimination against fat people or overweight people or people with high BMIs or whatever you want to call it, that kind of discrimination is something that should be perfectly legal, but that you just don't like it?
Well, it's already, Tom. I mean, it's already legal. I mean, you can on television shows, and there's a whole lot of gymnasiums. There's a lot of places where it is perfectly legal to discriminate based on looks, based on weight, based on a lot of factors.
But we're talking about a hospital.
Sure. You know, yeah, I mean, I think it seems, you know, on a legal basis, I think it's a stretch. But I don't know that it should be cross the threshold of being totally illegal that the government.
But you're willing to entertain the notion that big government should make it illegal.
Well, Tom, you know, I think that we have, you know, this is something that, first of all, nobody is debating this. This is one of those questions where, even if you believe in a much less regulated society, this is not something that's on the table. So it's kind of a pointless conversation. But I wish that this stuff wasn't.
You know, to take the gotcha out of it, because, you know, Carrie, you want a big government. I mean, that's a gotcha question. But to actually, you know, kind of turn it into a more rational conversation, isn't there a point where the public good is helped and individuals, particularly in minority groups, are hurt when we the people, when society, when the government, when we the people don't offer some sort of protection to those minority groups?
You know, absolutely. And I think that this is, but it is one of those balancing acts, because I do think that we can all say that sometimes government is able to do good things by making laws and preventing things like discrimination, but those often do come at a cost. And I think that even when we think about some of the good things that the government's been able to do in outlawing discrimination, there's often, you know, we've got to think carefully about it.
Discrimination based? I get it. If you're trying out for a movie and the role calls, you know, for a person.
But I mean, Tom, in the same way that we agree that there's speech and something white supremacist type speech, you know, we all think this is super bad.
No, I'm talking about discrimination in the workplace. I mean, Hooters is not going to hire me, right?
Sure. So, no, absolutely.
You know, yeah, and I'm not going to bring a suit against them. But a hospital is, you know, it's just it's a place of public facility. And for a hospital to say it. And frankly, I would submit to you, Carrie, that there are probably a lot of employers in America who won't hire obese people, and it's just plain old bigotry. It's a particular type of bigotry. They you know, for whatever reason, and I think the primary reason would be that there's a stigma associated with being overweight in our society, and they would rather have, you know, attractive in quotes, right? Because there are some people who think overweight people are attractive, but some employers don't. And is this, You know, now that we're learning more and more that things like being grossly obese, I mean, morbidly obese, typically are not the result of lifestyle choices, that there is something going on with people's body, or there is something going on with our society, like high fructose corn syrup in our diets.
Yeah.
Isn't it appropriate then to begin protecting those people with laws against discrimination?
Well, you know, I think I think that we can solve this problem more on a cultural basis.
In other words, no.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think that we should, yeah, I don't think we've reached that threshold yet, although I agree with you that this is bad, but there's a lot of bad things that go on that government isn't the right solution to, or more government's not going to be the best way to solve it.
Okay. Carrie Lucas, the managing director of the Independent Women's Forum, IWF.org. Carrie, say hello to Europe for me.
I sure will. Thanks
okay.
so much.
Thanks a lot for the call. And good talking with you. We'll be right back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So where do we draw the lines on where we allow businesses, which we give special rights to discriminate against people? So, you know, the amazing thing about the Buffett rule yesterday was that, and we can continue the conversation about, you know, where do we draw the lines on discrimination in the United States, and should government be involved in enforcing anti-discrimination laws? And at the same time, should government be involved in enforcing tax laws that say that if you earn more than $1 million a year, which is a hell of a lot of money, right? That's a little less than $100,000 a month. If you earn over $1 million a year and you pay a maximum 15% income tax on it, like Mitt Romney does, then your second million, and Mitt made $21 million, so his next $20 million, instead of paying only 13.9%, which is what Mitt Romney paid, you would pay 30% on that. That's the Buffett rule, right? That actually won yesterday in the United States Senate in as much as it got more than 50 votes. But the Republicans filibustered it. They refused to allow them to end debate on it. The cloture vote went down and, you know, 54 to 43, as I recall it was. And so 54 people said, yes, we like the Buffett rule. 43 said no, but you had to have 60 to overcome a Republican filibuster. So Mitch McConnell filibustered the Buffett rule yesterday. One Republican, Susan Collins of Maine, voted in favor of it. One Democrat voted against it. And Mr. Pryor of Arkansas. And that's it. No Buffett rule. It's going to be real interesting to see how this thing plays out. But now the question is the Romney rule. The Romney rule is that, you know, Mitt wants, you know, he's making virtually all of the money that he's making right now. He's getting in the form of capital gains, dividends, things like that, where he pays a maximum 15% income tax. But if he doesn't become president and he decided to go back to work, which he probably won't, he's worth $250 million. I mean, you know. I don't think he's going to take his wife's maid's job or his wife's chef's job or his wife's, you know, or his valet's job or, you know, he's just, you know. Maybe he could be Warren Buffett's valet. You think? No, I doubt it. In any case, if Mitt took a job, he could pay up to 35-36% income tax, and he doesn't like that. He doesn't think anybody should pay that, so he wants to drop that down to 25%. And on the other hand, the Walmart greeters, who right now aren't paying any federal income taxes because they're making so little or at the poverty line and they can't afford to have both rent, food, and medicine, he wants those people to start paying taxes. So Mitt wants to drop taxes on the super rich, on the Romney rich. He wants to raise taxes on working people. This is called the Romney rule. And the Republicans in the Senate yesterday blocked the Buffett rule. So we'll see what happens with the Romney rule. Now, a variation of the Romney rule passed the House of Representatives, which is run by the Republicans. All the Republicans, you know, John Boehner and Eric Cantor and Mitch and Paul Ryan and all these guys in the House, they're all gung-ho for the Romney rule. So we'll see where this goes. Meanwhile, Secret Service is looking into Ted Nugent. This is incredible. This guy, another multimillionaire, who was at the NRA convention along with Mitt Romney and went off on President Obama and said that if Obama's reelected, that next year Ted Nugent will either be dead or in jail. Now, what could he do if President Obama gets reelected that could cause him to either be dead or in jail? Inquiring minds want to know, including the Secret Service. I'm inclined to think that this is just good old-fashioned hyperbole, but who knows? But anyhow, about Mitt's tax returns, this is clip number two, Jacob. This is Mitt being asked in one of the debates, when are you going to release your tax returns? Now, keep in mind, April 15th, April 17th, tax day is come and gone, okay? Here's what Mitt, however, had to say a few months ago.
When will you release your tax returns specifically?
When they're completed this year in April, I'll release my returns in April and probably for other years as well.
Yeah, except now we discover that he filed for an extension. And so maybe it'll be next April that we find out how much he paid this last year and who knows. In fact, they even went a little farther. And what I find particularly interesting about this is that this is another clip from one of the debates, that when Romney starts waffling, keep in mind the entire audience is Republicans, they start booing him. Republicans want to know, you know, when you're the ultra rich, when you're the Romney rich, how does that work? Here's the Mitster trying to make sense of this one.
Your father set a groundbreaking standard in American politics. He released his tax returns. He released them for not 1 year, but for 12 years. And when he did that, he said this: 1 year could be a fluke, perhaps done for show. When you release yours, will you follow your father's example?
Maybe. I don't know how many years I'll release. I'll take a look at what our documents are. And I'll release multiple years. I don't know how many years, but I'll be happy to do that.
Yeah, being booed by Republicans. You know, you've got a problem there. And this is what Chris Christie had to say. Clip number five here, Jacob.
What I would say to Governor Romney is, if you have tax returns to put out, you should put them out. You put them out sooner rather than later, because it's always better, in my view, to have complete disclosure, and especially when you're the front runner.
So this is all from the website What's Mitt Hiding? What is Mitt hiding? We know he's got a Swiss bank account. We know he's got a bank account in the Cayman Islands. There's a pretty reasonable certainty that he's using these with his retirement funds to avoid paying income taxes. What else is Mitt hiding?
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Inquiring minds want to know. And how are the Republicans going to win an election having voted against the Buffett rule? Unbalanced is the Tom Hartman Program. Elizabeth in Inkster, Michigan. Hey, Elizabeth. I used to live right next door to Inkster in Westland.
Oh, that's wonderful. It's a great community, isn't it?
It is.
I've been on the phone in queue for 4 days trying to talk to you because I have several things on my heart that I wanted to share if I could.
Try to keep them as short as possible. There's 12 other people.
I'm not
going to
be wordy. Can you go from one to the other, though?
We try to keep it to one topic per caller, but go for it.
Well, okay. To the woman who talked about how she doesn't think there should be a law against not hiring someone who's overweight,
mm-hmm.
My 2 points on that are, will this trickle down to discrimination against the patients who are overweight? Because if you have this view of being overweight as something that's, bad or wrong, you know, maybe you're not going to treat those overweight patients as well as you treat the other ones.
That's an excellent point.
Second point is that when you see an overweight person, you never know why they're overweight. Mm-hmm. Living in Michigan, where people have traditionally been stuck in their house in the winter most of the year, winter used to be 6 months. Now it's only 2 months because of global warming. But people stuck in tiny trailers, they can't go outside because the weather, they'll get overweight. Also, some people have thyroid issues, or they had surgeries or illnesses, and during recovery.
I grew up in Michigan, and many years ago. And when I was a little kid in the 50s and 60s, there were not a lot of overweight people in Michigan. Now there are. I'm back in Michigan every year to visit all my family. And yes. I think it's because you can't walk into a restaurant in Michigan in particular, but, you know, pretty much anywhere in the country. But the Midwest is particularly bad with this regard because you've got, you know, basically low-end fast food restaurants. You can't walk into a restaurant and buy a drink that's not filled with high fructose corn syrup.
Absolutely.
And most of the food is as well. I mean, the ketchup economy is laced with it.
Right, and the economy is bad, so people have to go to these fast food restaurants and buy high starchy items or high fat items that are cheaper on the menu because that's all they can afford. The healthier food is so expensive you can't afford it.
Yeah, I'm completely with you, Elizabeth. I'm going to move along. Thank you very much for the call. You got two in there. That was good. Nate in Annapolis. Hey, Nate, what's up?
Hey, Tom, how you doing?
Great. What's on your mind?
Okay, so I wanted to get your thoughts on the Buffett rule. I know you've been talking a lot today about the Republican effort to basically shoot it down in the Senate.
Well, it wasn't an effort. They were successful.
Okay. My point is this. We've spoken before. I agree that the Buffett rule is a good idea. I think that it's wrong that Warren Buffett pays less to tax than a secretary. That being said, I just don't understand why several people and, you know, from all sides of the political spectrum are demagoguing this issue. It's going to raise maybe $4 billion in revenue.
Because if you're suggesting that this issue is demagoguery, let me just lay this out. The spirit of the times was changed. We had in the United States from the time of the Great Depression, when Franklin Roosevelt raised the top tax rate from the 25% that Warren Harding had set it at when he dropped it down from 90% in 1920. Franklin Roosevelt raised it from 25% up to 91%, and it sat there for almost 50 years, the 30s, the 40s, the 50s, the 60s, the 70s. In the late 60s and 70s, it was a 74%, but it was well above 50% all that time until Reagan came along. During that time, everybody, Republican presidents like Nixon and Eisenhower, Democratic presidents like Kennedy and Truman and Lyndon Johnson and Jimmy Carter, they all agreed this was a good thing for the country because it stabilized the economy and it built the middle class. Reagan came in with this greed is good thing right from day one. Carter's inaugural ball had been kind of a low-key affair, and they, you know, limousines not welcome. Carter actually walked to his inaugural down Pennsylvania Avenue. Reagan, everything was limousines and star-studded and diamonds and you know, everything. Money was on display, and very, very rich people were lionized, and greed is good became the mantra of the 1980s. And Americans stopped thinking of themselves as working people and started thinking of themselves as temporarily inconvenienced millionaires. And you had this explosion of get-rich-quick schemes. You, too, can get rich quick. I'm sure you've seen them. From things that were punched, you know, thumbnailed onto telephone poles to ads on TV. How to buy a home with no interest down, and then you rent it out, and now you've got some equity, and then you buy another home using that one as the equity, and then you know, pretty soon you own 8 or 10 homes, and you're making all this income, and you're getting rich in your spare time, and I got a $10,000 a month income, and I did it all, no money down, and I got a net worth of $12 million. Remember all those ads? That was Zeitgeist is a German word that means spirit of the time. Zeit is time, Geist is ghost, right? The ghost of the times, the spirit of the times. And the spirit of the times from Reagan's election until pretty much now, or at least until the beginning of the Bush Great Depression, the great crash in 2008 under George W. Bush. The spirit of the times was greed is good, and the rich should get richer, and maybe the table scraps will fall down on the rest of us. The Buffett rule is a very imperfect tool to take that on. Frankly, I think instead of having the Buffett rule, I think that what should have been done is just roll back the Reagan tax cuts. Let's just go back to the way things were for 50 years. They served this country really well. But, you know, I'm not an advisor to the president. They don't pay much attention to me, and which is just fine. That's their right. And so nobody's talking about rolling back the Reagan tax cuts. They're not even talking about going back to the Bill Clinton tax levels of 39%. Instead, the president came up with this very generous offer to the people who are Romney rich. You know, Romney, people who make over $20 million a year. People who make over $1 million a year. I mean, the poor end of the Romney rich. And the proposal was that, you know, your first $1 million, you can pay a maximum 15% income tax like Mitt Romney does on your first $1 million. That's fine. Even though your secretary, assuming she's making a couple $100,000, is going to have to pay up to 35%. You can still only pay 15% on that first $1 million. After that, you pay 30%. Now, the top tax rate is 35%, so you're still paying less than your secretary. So, you know, I consider it a very imperfect tool. It's a compromise that's like, what a compromise, right? I mean, this is so generous to the Romney rich. But the main reason for it wasn't to raise money. And this is why I think it's so sad when Republicans call this show or people from the various think tanks or whatnot, and they've got the talking points in front of them and they're reading it. And, you know, this isn't going to raise enough money to close the deficit. Why are you demagoguing this issue? Of course, it's not going to raise enough money to close the deficit. What it's going to do, though, is change the spirit of the times. You start getting some legislative victories. It's like, for example, in the 1960s, prior to the mid-1960s in America, there was this notion that the races should be separated. Miscegenation, the laws against black people marrying white people or vice versa, were in place right up until 1967. In states around the United States. You had legally segregated school districts up until 1954, and many of them stayed that way up until, you know, Bobby Kennedy as Attorney General started really kicking butt in the 60s, and then Lyndon Johnson. And then so the zeitgeist, the spirit of the times, had first been slavery, and then after the Civil War, it was separate but equal. And that lasted up until the 1960s. And then when the civil rights laws were passed, again, they didn't solve the problem overnight. But they changed the spirit of the times. And led directly to the creation of a fairly substantial African-American middle class in the United States. And to the notion among the younger generation now that, you know, so what? He's African American, or so what? He's Caucasian. It doesn't matter. So what? He's Hispanic, or she's Asian, or you know, fill in the blanks. It doesn't matter. It changed the spirit of the times. And the goal of the Buffett rule, if I'm reading this right, wasn't so much to raise money, because it's not going to raise that much money. I mean, it's going to raise an amount of money that would pay for the operations in Afghanistan for, you know, a few months. Maybe. But it is the beginning of a change in the spirit of the times, the zeitgeist. And that's important. Symbolism is important. When Ronald Reagan changed the presidential inaugural to becoming a gala ball for multimillionaires, for which they paid big bucks to show up, he changed the spirit of the times. It was called the Reagan Revolution. Gordon Gekko came along, you know, fictional character, but, you know, greed is good. Everybody went, yep. Reagan changed the spirit of the times, and now Obama's trying to change the spirit of the times. That's what's it about. That's what it's
You're
about.
Listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And frankly, it's a change that we very, very much need. We'll be back at the Talk Radio News Service. Tax man, I think today is it today, Victoria, is today the drop dead date or was it yesterday?
Drop dead date is today.
It's today for taxes, with regard to the tax man. And how come it wasn't yesterday?
Maybe that kind.
Oh, yesterday was a holiday?
No, it was because it fell on a Sunday.
Oh, I see.
So they give us like the Saturday and the Sunday equivalent.
I see. Okay. So Monday became Saturday and today is
Sunday.
Yeah. No, but today is Tuesday, but it's actually Friday.
for
tax purposes. Anyhow, what's going on in the world?
Well, the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops today wrote a couple of letters, one to the House Agriculture Committee, one to the Ways and Means Committee. This is the first of several letters criticizing the House passed Republican budget. That would be the Ryan budget, for cutting food stamps and other assistance programs for the poor. To say that these letters sort of politely excoriated the budget is an understatement. Bishops say the budget fails to meet certain moral criteria, disproportionately cuts programs serve poor and vulnerable people. Also says that it cuts to nutrition programs such as supplemental nutrition assistance program will hurt hungry children, poor families, vulnerable seniors and workers who cannot find employment. These cuts are unjustified and wrong.
This is the thing that amazes me, Victoria, is, you know, I've pointed out many times in this program, the Catholic Church or people within the Catholic Church, well, both actually, have for a long time, actually, you know, recent history, been at the forefront of much positive social change.
Right.
And you'll never hear this on Fox News. You won't hear this on right-wing media. You'll hear them echo the Catholic Church's position on abortion and birth control, which is, shall we say, conservative or consistent with, you know, Republican theology or positions. But you'll never hear them talk about how the Catholic Church, as you just pointed out, says, you know, people should have food. People, you know, people should have health care. The Pope has said health care should be a right.
Right.
And you know, why don't, well, I know why the Republicans and the conservatives don't point that out. Of course, you know, it would show them to be hypocrites. But I'm surprised that Catholics let the right wingers exploit them like this.
I'm amazed. I mean, they even said spending cuts should be made to subsidy programs that, quote, disproportionately go to large growers and agribusiness. I mean, they got right deep down and dirty. It's very interesting because, I mean, the Catholic Church's positions on a number of these particular types of issues is really very liberal, and you never hear it talked about. You never hear it talked about. Because now Paul Ryan says that his Catholic faith shaped the budget and says the budget is consistent with Catholic teachings.
Except that the Catholic bishops of the United States disagree with him.
They disagree.
Aggressively.
Very aggressively. We've just had two letters so far. They've got more up their sleeves and are forthcoming.
Amazing. Okay. What else is up?
Tomorrow, Vice President Joe Biden, who wrote the original 1994 Violence Against Women Act, is going to headline an event pushing for the bill's reauthorization. And the event will be at the White House. He'll be flanked by Attorney General Eric Holder and top White House advisor Valerie Jarrett and others. Now, the Democrats and the White House are really intensifying their push to expand the Violence Against Women Act this week. They want to try and get the narrative back on women's issues. It went off last week for the party after Hillary Rosen's comments, and everybody got in a flap about that, and nobody took any notice of the fact that Mitt Romney had made remarks in January saying that women with two-year-olds should go out and get the dignity of work. Nobody jumped on that, which was interesting.
Yes. Well, we mentioned it here, but Fox News never mentioned that?
Well, it didn't become a meme. It didn't reverberate.
Right, because there wasn't a machine behind it.
Exactly. So the White White House is hoping that an appeal to the bipartisan nature of the bill, 8 Republican senators have signed on so far, and it has bipartisan sponsors, too. It has Mike Crapo and it has Patrick Leahy. He hopes that then the issue of public safety is going to get it really to go through the Senate, even though there are conservatives objecting to it. But we don't know whether that's going to happen because the new provisions in the law are things that Senator Charles Grassley and some conservative organizations have really taken against. It does expand protections for LGBT victims of domestic violence and forbids discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation or gender.
Mm-hmm.
It also expands the availability of visas for undocumented immigrants who've been victims of domestic violence and might be reluctant to come forward because of the risk of deportation.
Wow. This is like reasonable and healthy stuff.
Yeah, and it also provides limited jurisdiction to efforts to prosecute Indian and non-Indian offenders in domestic violence cases.
As in a Native American Indian.
Native American Indian cases, yeah.
So reboot this from the very beginning because I must have missed something. This is in the Senate.
This is in the Senate, the Violence Against Women Act. Now,
okay, so this is going to die in the House, though, isn't it? I mean, the Tea Partiers, the violence against women is not one of their issues, or am I wrong?
Well, you so often see the end in the beginning, Tom. That's why it's so interesting to talk to you. Exactly. Even if this limps through the Senate, which it might, it has to go to the House. And what's going to happen to it in the House? It's going to undergo significant changes in the House.
Right. I personally don't think that Paul Ryan or John Boehner or Eric Cantor give a rat's patootie about violence against women. It's just, and if anything, I would say that they have been at the forefront of the war against women, fighting against the Lilly Ledbetter Act, the Fair Pay Act, for example. But fortunately that was passed before they controlled the House. Anyhow, that's my opinion. You're reporting, so. Any other reports?
Just very briefly, new evidence cited in the Secret Service prostitution inquiry. One thing is that agents included in this were snipers, others who work with explosives.
Mm-hmm.
They all took women to their rooms, all 11 Secret Service personnel. They have sent Secret Service agents to Colombia to question the women. Senator Susan Collins of Maine is concerned that some of them, we don't know who they were, whether they had ties to groups hostile to the United States.
Mm.
And so that investigation is ongoing.
I think these agents were just looking for somebody to have a nice conversation.
Exactly.
Yeah. Just like they did during the Kennedy administration.
That's right.
Victoria Jones, TalkRadioNews.com. Thank you, Victoria.
Thank you.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Argentina, yesterday, the country down in South America, remember? They said no to the IMF back in 2000, 2001. I was down there in 2002, as I recall, and it was an economic disaster. Out of that disaster, all these co-ops started out. Businesses were just shutting their doors and saying, that's it, we're out of here. And the workers took them over. Argentina has on a per capita basis, among the most co-ops in the world now. And they elected Cristina Fernandez, a relatively progressive politician, as their president. And the president before her had sold off the oil company, basically all the oil in Argentina, had sold this off to a giant Spanish company. In fact, the president before her, he was sort of the Ronald Reagan of the day, and it was during the Reagan times, and he privatized the energy industry, he privatized the he tried to privatize Social Security, he privatized the water supplies, he privatized the sewage, he privatized all kinds of things, and among them, oil. And Argentina has said, no, not so much. We're gonna take that thing back. YPF, which is the Argentinian company, is now going to buy 51% of itself back from the Spanish energy giant Repsol. Now, Congress is going to have to do this, and it looks like it's going to be passed. The Cristina Fernandez, who is the president, says she's going to force this confrontation with Spain. Meanwhile, in Spain, the economic minister said this would turn Argentina into, his phrase, an international pariah, and he called it an aggressive act. Now, Argentina has a lot of oil. Problem, though, is that that oil isn't owned by Argentina. As I mentioned, back during the Reagan era, Argentina's Reagan was a guy by the name of Carlos Menem. He privatized the nation's oil industry. He privatized their post office. Anyhow, their oil industry ended up being owned by a Spanish company, Repsol, and Argentina President Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner. I knew it was Cristina Kirchner is her actual name. My apologies. Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner pointed out, we are the only country in the Americas and nearly the world that doesn't control its own natural resources. This is the recuperation of the sovereignty of Argentina's natural resources, end quote. Spanish are all freaked out. They're calling it crazy. They're in Europe. Argentina's in South America. They both speak Spanish, but you got this. But the government of Spain, they're calling it hostile. They called it almost an act of war. New York bankster Boris Segura said it's running close to Chavez's model. So, you know, Hugo Chavez nationalized his oil. He uses it to feed poor people and housing for poor people and medical care for everybody in Venezuela. Can't have that. Oil is supposed to make billionaires. The fact of the matter, in my opinion, is that every country should own its own oil. We should own our own oil. I mean, are the Saudis, they own their own oil. Are they like Chavez? Or Sarah Palin's Alaska, which takes money from their oil, distributes it to their citizens every year. Sarah Palin's Hugo Chavez, because she was writing $2,000 checks to everybody. Argentina's President Kirchner is spot on. She should nationalize her nation's oil. Should have done it a long time ago. Instead of having to buy, right now, Argentina has to buy their own oil from a European company. We should be nationalizing our oil here, so we don't have to buy it back from British BP or Dutch Shell. Every nation should own its own natural resources. They should develop their own natural resources. Those natural resources are part of the Commonwealth, right? As in Commonwealth of Massachusetts. And the revenue from them should fund social programs like in Norway. They get a lot of oil. They sell that oil. What do they do with the money? It pays for their health care program, among other things. You know, I guess to our relief, one of the reasons America is not getting into this is because President Kirchner is not, Cristina Kirchner, Fernandez de Kirchner, is not nationalizing her oil away from an American company. Now, when Iran and Iraq and Venezuela, when they tried that, when they tried to take their oil away from ExxonMobil and ITT, ATT, whatever, no, it was... it was ExxonMobil, Chevron, Standard, all those various companies. What happened? The CIA helped overthrow all of them. These were all three democratically elected governments, although in Venezuela, the coup was very short-lived. In fact, Louise and I were there that day. We were in Venezuela the day that they put Chavez under arrest. It was a very short-lived coup. But it was a coup by the elites. This was back in the 80s. It's time for the U.S. government to stop doing the bidding of transnational oil companies, including you and me paying the full cost of militarily protecting their shipping lanes and fighting wars in foreign countries to help them get more oil. And we should be considering nationalizing our own oil supplies and many of our other minerals for the benefit of we the people. Instead of the benefit like people like ExxonMobil's Lee Raymond, who got a $400 million retirement bonus. Can you imagine the day you retire, this guy had already made millions and millions and millions of dollars. And he retires, and they say, here's a check for $400 million. Largest retirement in history. You know, the resources of a nation should be for the nation, not for the billionaires like ExxonMobil, Lee Raymond, the Koch brother company, stuff like that. It's time for us to seriously ask the question, you know, what is the commons in this country? Most Americans don't even, I shouldn't say most Americans don't understand the concept of the commons. That's where I was going with that. I think most Americans intuitively understand the concept of the commons. But what they don't get is that there has historically been a debate in the United States about where the commons begins and ends. And we've pretty much always figured that the commons is the police, the army, the fire department, the post office, the schools. It was Thomas Jefferson's radical idea that college was part of the commons. He started the University of Virginia as a free college. Abraham Lincoln expanded that by saying that we're going to give land, we're going to give federal land to states to build what are called land-grant colleges, because they got grants from the federal government of land. We'll give you the land, you build a college, you got a state college. And there's dozens of them all over the country. Michigan State University was one of them, land-grant college. This was Abraham Lincoln's project. You look at most other countries, you can go to college for free. Not most other, not as in all, you know, 190 some odd countries in the world, but most other developed countries, the other 30 or 40 countries that are the developed countries of the world, they're investing in their intellectual infrastructure. They own their own natural resources, or they very tightly control them. And they consider healthcare to be part of the commons. And Obamacare is like a small step in that direction. And what's really cool about it is that in 2014 to 2017, it gives the states the ability to do what they did in Canada, which is experiment with their own single-payer system, which Vermont is already down the road in doing. We need a conversation about the common in this country.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And what's going on in Argentina might just spark that conversation. Should we nationalize our oil? Take it away from the Koch brothers and ExxonMobil?
Everyone addicted to the same nicotine. Everyone addicted to the same gasoline. Everyone addicted to a Technicolor screen. Everybody trying to get their hands on the same green. From the banks of the river.
Occupying the media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. Tom Hartman here with you. Dominic in Chicago, Illinois, listening to Chicago's Progressive Talk. Hey, Dominic, what's up?
Hey, how you doing, Tom?
Great.
I had a question for you. I guess I've been pondering for several days now. Since the Romney rich are complaining about the possibility of having to pay half of 1% over the $1 million, I know they have no problem paying and donating all this money to all these organizations, you know, for the corporations and everything else for political campaigns. So there's an irony in that. But I guess, why don't we help them out? You know, Bernie Sanders is doing a fabulous job, and so is movetoamend.org. But I guess I'm looking at it from a different standpoint, and I'm wondering if this could happen. I mean, originally, before Citizens United, we had limits on what corporations could donate and what people could donate, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
It was $2,000 bucks for people, and corporations couldn't contribute anything.
Right. So why don't we go back to that law? And
because the Supreme Court struck it down.
But the Supreme Court did that illegally because they mandated that as a law when actually that was not in their jurisdiction to do that.
Well, you and I agree with that, but you know, most law schools don't. Most legislators don't. The Congress has given incredible deference to the Supreme Court. And
why doesn't the Democratic Party, including our president, push that issue, and then we could go back to that? Then we could utilize all that extra money, Tom, to do all of our social networks, education.
Here's why, Dominic. I sat down with the legislative director, you know, the lawyer who deals with legal issues for a member of Congress who I will not name and was not Bernie. And I sat down with this guy for about 20, 30 minutes and started, you know, talking about Citizens United because I've got a reputation, not just in this town, but all over the country, as knowing something about that. I wrote the first book on the topic, right? Unequal Protection came out in 2001. And
every book you do is great.
Yeah, well, thank you. And so I'm talking to this guy and we're going through the whole history of it in Santa Clara County and all this. And he's right along with me. And then I just, you know, made the kind of an offhand comment about, you know, and furthermore, in my opinion, the Supreme Court shouldn't even have the right to strike down laws based on constitutionality. And this guy's a lawyer and he works for a congressman. And he says, what are you talking about? And I said, Marbury versus Madison, 1803. And he goes, yeah, that's when judicial review was established. The Supreme Court, you know, established judicial review at that time. That's stare decisis. That's been law for over 200 years. And I said, well, I think it's bad law. And I think it's wrong. And I don't think it's what the founders intended. And all of a sudden, it was as if I had said to him, oh, by the way, did you know that there's a flying saucer outside and there's guys from Mars in it? I mean, it was even more than if I had said, hey, I figured out who did 9/11 and it's grandmother in Paducah, Iowa, you know, or whatever. I mean, you know, I totally became a conspiracy nut in this guy's mind as soon as I started talking about judicial review. And I finally, you know, the thing that saved me was I said, you need to read Larry Kramer's book on judicial review because it's a very thoughtful analysis that critiques this. And he's like, who's Larry Kramer? And I'm saying, he's the dean of the Stanford Law School. And he said, there's a dean of a law school who agrees with you? And I said, yes, he wrote a book about it. And he said, well, I'll read the book. And his way of dismissing me. But the point is that you're not going to get the Democratic Party on board with this. You can't even get their lawyers on board with this. These people, you know, most legislators are lawyers, and they are so well indoctrinated in law school that this is established law that maybe even this is what the founders intended. There are fragments of Federalist Number 80 where Hamilton basically says this is how it should be, even though he contradicts himself a few paragraphs later. And so, you know, it ain't going to happen. And that's why we've got to do two things. We've got to amend the Constitution to say money is not speech, it is property, and corporations are not people. They are legal artifices, you know, created by the state. And secondly, we need to make sure that the next couple of Supreme Court justices who decide to retire or, God forbid, you know, just kick off from typically old age or something, that they're replaced by a Democratic president. Because if they're replaced by Mitt Romney, you know, can you say Judge Bork? Or Clarence Thomas, or Antonin Scalia, or John Roberts, or you know, Sam Alito. I mean, it's just that's how bad it's going
to
get.
Enough to get Kennedy.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean,
well,
you know,
Tom, why can't we limit the media, though? Why can't we take the media and limit what they're able to do financially? Why can't we put that back in place?
Because, again, it is because the Supreme Court has said that actually the rationale that they used in the Citizens United decision was not so much, and you read the entire decision, there is a reference to it. Most of the references are in the dissent, actually. It wasn't so much that corporations have a right to speak. The rationale that was used by John Roberts, and he had Kennedy write the thing, but he was basically dictating it. The rationale that he used for the Citizens United decision was because, and this is, I'm paraphrasing their language pretty closely here, because the major economic players in the United States, the major players in our economy are corporations, and they have people working for them who are very, very well informed about economic issues. It does you and me as well-informed voters a disservice not to be able to hear their voices. So the argument that was framed in Citizens United was not so much that the corporations have a right to speak, but that you and I have not just the right, but the need to hear what they have to say. And so if you go about the process of trying to limit the transmission or communication of corporate speech by, for example, putting a limit on television or radio broadcasting by them, then you are not only going against the word of Citizens United, but you're going against the core spirit of it, the core argument that was made. And that's why it ain't going to happen. Dominic, I'm totally with you. It all should. But, you know, we've got a lot of educating to do, and we've just started.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
So how do we do this? Well, it's an inside game and an outside game. Sarah Robinson wrote this brilliant piece about it in Alternate a couple days ago. I got to share some pieces of it with you. Yep, that's the good, the bad, and the very, very philogastriciously ugly, brought to you by EdisonFactor.com, a supplement for the brain. The good, Eric Schoenberg. Despite the Republicans' filibuster of the Buffett rule last night, it seems like more and more millionaires are ready and willing to pay their fair share of taxes. Case in point, Eric Schoenberg. Schoenberg, a wealthy investment banker, was interviewed on MSNBC yesterday. He told Chris Jansing,
I think my taxes are too low. In 2009, for example, I paid 1% of my income in federal income taxes. It is ridiculous that I pay substantially lower taxes than the average working American.
Mr. Schoenberg is right. The logic is ridiculous. There are dozens of wealthy Americans who, like Schoenberg, want to pay higher taxes to help our nation and our economy. Republicans need to start listening to their wishes and stop protecting corporate interests. The bad, Fox News, or Fox so-called news. Yesterday, the Romney campaign chose the advisor responsible for vetting and choosing a VP candidate. Of course, this was breaking news over at Fox so-called news, so the talking heads had to weigh in. Shortly after the announcement, the official Fox and Friends Twitter account tweeted, Romney has hired an advisor to do his VP search. Who should we choose? Fox News chief Roger Ailes and political pundits of the network deny their relationship with the political party, but with comments like these, they're not fooling anyone. And the very, very ugly, the U.S. Department of Defense. A report on CNN over the weekend revealed that women in each branch of the military are routinely diagnosed with mental conditions and dismissed from duty after filing sexual harassment complaints. Sexual assaults of women in the military are on the rise and are far too common. Last year, 19,000 sexual assaults were reported, while many went unreported. Women in our military serve our country with bravery and honor, and they are rewarded with such sexual assaults and government cover-ups. The fact that the military would rather cast away these American heroes than protect them is very, very ugly. It's extremely ugly. The six people you need to start a revolution. We need this, Sarah. I encourage you. Sarah Robinson and I had this conversation last night. You can see the video of it over at YouTube.com. Well, you can just there's a link to it off TomHartman.com. It's right on our homepage. And the six groups, the six people that you need in order to have a successful revolution or revolutionary movement, a change movement, a genuine change movement. You need the activists. Okay, we've got that. That's Occupy Wall Street. You need the intellectuals. You need the Noam Chomskys of the world, the Howard Zinns of the world, the people, the thinkers. You need the artists. You need people to translate what's being thought about and what's being done into performance art, into, getting things out there. You need the insiders. Okay, now the insiders, whether it's insiders inside organizations like MoveOn.org, the more established organizations, or whether it's inside Congress, you need those people. In fact, when you hit those people, according to Karl Marx, a revolution is going to be successful when insiders begin to defect and support it. And you need the elites. Again, according to Karl Marx, a revolution is successful when the elites begin peeling off the establishment and start supporting the movement. So the other day, Ben Cohen came on our program of Ben and Jerry's Ice Cream and talked about how he was giving money to Occupy Wall Street to fund a very specific program of theirs. When elites begin to fund movements, movements take off. And then finally, you have activists, intellectuals, artists, insiders, supportive elites. You need the masses. You need all the people. And the masses follow everything else. And once you've got the masses, then guess who gets on board? The politicians, and it becomes law. It becomes change. It becomes something new and different. Culture changes. The zeitgeist changes. So that's my rant for the day. Chris in Amherst, courtesy of Sarah Robinson. Chris in Amherst, Mass. Listen to WHMP. Hey, Chris, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Yeah, you know, in terms of you were talking about informing people about the commons, I don't think it would work because, you know, in my 53 years, I found that, you know, you can't reason with madness. It just doesn't work. And in today's society, in terms of media stuff, information and truth is so fragmented. I mean, where's a regular citizen supposed to get the truth?
Yeah. Well, this is a problem in that we have these silos. People watch Fox News and read the Drudge Report, or you know, people watch Free Speech TV and read Truth Out, you know, and
right.
Never the Twain Shall Meet. But if you are interacting with a conservative, I would suggest that you try some of the techniques that I try on this program constantly. Like, for example, my favorite one is it's very hard to find a conservative who doesn't think that fire departments should be part of the commons. Okay, right. I realize there are some libertarians who think that it should be a for-profit thing. But most conservatives, virtually all Republicans, will say, of course, a fire department should be part of the commons. You say, well, why is that? Well, if my house is on fire, I don't mind paying a little bit in tax money to make sure it gets put out. And then you ask the question, well, isn't your body worth more than your house? Isn't your health more important than your house?
No, that's a very good point.
And if your body metaphorically catches on fire, you know, with cancer or you know, some god awful disease, shouldn't we all help put that fire out?
Right.
And you know, if you can come up with those kind of just very simple logical if thens, then
right.
You can begin cracking that shell, and then they start. And then the next time they hear, you know, Sean Hannity going off on, "Oh, you don't want the government telling you what doctor you can go to see." And they start thinking, well, wait a minute. Right now, my health insurance company tells me what doctor I can go see. Isn't that just as bad? In fact, it's worse because I can't vote my health insurance company out of office and replace it with somebody that agrees with me.
Right. But you might be forgetting that people can be controlled, Tom. I mean, look at Germany. Yeah. A whole nation was controlled to the point where they were going to take over the world.
And they woke up. They woke up.
Or were they beaten?
Well, it was both. But I would submit that had we not engaged in World War II with Adolf Hitler, within a generation, he would have been overthrown.
Well, and, I hope you're right, Tom.
Well, history demonstrates that. You know, the dictators typically, particularly crazed dictators and mass murdered dictators, tend not to live very long. I mean, you know, Pol Pot got overthrown in Cambodia, and it wasn't because we went in there and saved the day. A lot of dictators last a lot longer. Sometimes they live two or three generations, you know, 40, 50, 60 years. But eventually this too does pass. And what happens is when democracy is an endogenous process, when it's from within, then it tends to be far more resilient and far stronger. So, yeah, people can be controlled for a while. But as Martin Luther King said, the arc of justice may be long, but it bends toward justice? No, the arc of whatever. I'm mangling his quote, but you know what I'm saying.
Thank you for you just gave me a little bit of hope where I
okay. Chris, just consider how much
read some of your books.
Consider the fact that there are over 100 democracies in the world right now, and when this country was founded, there were zero. Right? Look at how far we've, and this is 7,000 years of history. Look at how far we've gone just in the last 230 years. We've got a lot. I agree. We have a lot farther to go, and we've got some very reactionary forces that we're fighting against. But this is in our DNA. I'm very optimistic about it. Chris, thanks for the call, and thanks for listening to WHMP. It is much appreciated. Dave in Hot Springs, Arkansas, watching us on Free Speech TV on DirecTV. Hey, Dave, what's up?
I heard you talking about Lee Raymond, and I'm an old schoolmate of his at the University of Wisconsin. And
oh, really?
Yeah. I didn't know him. I have to admit that.
Yeah.
But I did. We were both business school graduates, and you talk about lawyers being brainwashed coming out of law school. I mean, it's nothing compared to what a business school guy comes out as.
Oh, I remember one of my kids was taking a business class, and we were having this conversation, and you know, one of my kids was telling me about all this right-wing stuff that was coming out of this professor. And it just blew my mind.
Yeah, me too. And Unfortunately, too many of these guys take it to heart. When I mentioned that what we used to call pure economic rent, which was what you really didn't deserve,
right?
When you made that much money, $409 million after closing the door,
mm-hmm.
And I said to one of my right-wing wacko buddies, I said, that's absolutely insane.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, what are you talking about? He said, he earned that money. Well, the way he earned it was to be sitting in that CEO's seat when oil was $17 a barrel and went to $80 a barrel.
Right.
That's how he earned the money. It had
right.
nothing to do with him whatsoever.
Well, that, and he had an old boy network that he put in charge of the compensation committee on the board of directors who determined how much money he would get.
Absolutely.
And probably most of them were CEOs of other companies, and he sat on their compensation committees. I'm just guessing, but that's usually how it works.
That's right. They're lapdogs for one another.
Sure. It's become its own unique social class. The CEOs of America have become like the lords of 18th century England. You know, it is.
Corporations are kingdoms, and
yes,
and that's exactly the problem. If they were owned by employees, like Garel Perowitz,
yes,
mentions in his book, and maybe you've read it.
I have, and we also had him on as a Conversations with Great Mind guest. There's a half hour interview with him over at ConversationsWithGreatMinds.com that you can see, and he's been on this radio program as well.
Well, it's a great idea, and so is it Richard Wolff?
Yes. Richard Wolff, the economist. Yes.
Similar stuff.
Yep.
It's something to be aware of, something to think about.
Yep. I also, in fact, the last chapter of my book, Threshold, Louise and I went to Spain, to Mondragon, and we wrote all about that, about the importance of cooperatives. I'm with you, Dave. Thanks for the call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
In fact, the title of that chapter was In the Shadow of the Dragon. This was one of the most horrible places in Basque Country, and now it's the headquarters of a multi-billion dollar co-op.
From the war against disorder, from the sirens night and day, from the fires of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay. Democracy is coming to the USA.
10 minutes before the hour, yes, democracy is coming to the USA, step by step. Uh-oh, our Twilight Zone alert. Poltergeists at the pub. An ancient pub in Birmingham, England, is being frequented by a creepy customer, a groping ghost. Customers and staff at the 170-year-old Queen's Arms pub report that a ghost residing in their pub frequently pinches their bums. That's, the British use of the word bum, not the American. The staff have nicknamed the ghost Grasper after Casper the Friendly Ghost, except Grasper is a bit too friendly. Ashley Beeland, a waitress at the pub, is one of Grasper's bum-pinched victims, told a local newspaper. My instant reaction was that it might have been a sleazy bloke trying his luck, but when I spun around ready to give him a piece of my mind, there was no one there. Staff of the pub have called in a team of Ghostbusters to investigate Grasper and his paranormal pinching. So watch out, ladies. Drunken men may not be the only thing you have to deal with next time you go to a bar. At least that bar in merry old England. Very, very strange. Dan in Sterling Heights, Michigan. Hey, Dan, thanks for listening to WDTW. What's up?
Hi, Tom. The commons is probably one of my favorite topics. I love it when you bring it up. And commons and the common good, really, you know, the organizing principle of our society, you know,
mm-hmm.
that people forget.
Yeah, that's why we started this nation.
Right. And, you know, I think about Chris, the fellow that called in, and he feels discouraged, you know, how can you change minds? And I'm going to give a real practical example, and I hope people can use it. This is an actual conversation, Tom, I had with my neighbor,
mm-hmm.
Who is a very conservative, this is the woman, the wife of a couple. And, you know, let alone the fact that she has a very high needs, special needs kid and consumes more resources out of the public school system than most, but that's a different conversation.
Right.
I said to her, I said, okay, how much are you willing to pay to have your street plowed, the snow cleared from in front of your property? And she kind of looked at me and she said, well, I don't know. And I said, well, you need to think about it. I said, because, you know, if we're going to go away from government, if government is bad, you're going to have to figure that out. She says, I don't know, maybe $1,500 a year. And I said, well, here's the problem. I don't want to pay any. So if I don't plow the street in front of my house, you can't go anywhere because you're my neighbor.
I said, so really the concept of the commons is we all have to pay in or none of us are going anywhere.
Right. We're all in it together.
Yeah. And it stopped her in her tracks, and she sort of thought about it. And I said, you know, think about how many things that applies to, neighbor, you know, the sewer, the power lines, you know, as you and I talked about a week ago, Tom, you know, the phone system, as a matter of fact, 15 states have introduced legislation to do away with requiring landline service by phone companies. You know, that's under attack, too. It's just about anything we can think of. It's part of the commons and a result of, an organization built around the common good.
Yes. Well said. That's a great example, Dan. Thank you for calling and sharing that. I appreciate it. Great to hear from you. And David in Richmond, Virginia. Hey, David, what's up?
Hey, there's a new Senate bill out there, Senate Bill 2109.
Right.
Brought up by John McCain and John Kyle.
The two Republicans from Arizona and Texas specifically, yes, or respectively.
Yeah, they're not respectful. They're a couple of... anyway,
respectively.
Bill 2109 goes after the Native American, the Navajo and the Hopi Indian tribe in Arizona. They have their own particular, you know, land of water, quite much of it.
Right.
Anyway, this new bill takes the water rights away from them, gives them just enough to sustain their reservation or whatever, and they want to give it to the Peabody coal mining outfit, corporation.
Man. Yeah.
All right? In other words, they want to take something else, once again, from Native Americans. I'm really high about this one. And also, if the Peabody Corporation, there's no regulation on them. So in other words, if they pollute the water, then the Indians get sick. Also in this bill, it says Peabody's not responsible and the Native Americans cannot sue them.
Amazing. I can't speak to this because I don't know about the details of Senate Bill 2109. But if what you're saying is true, that is truly horrific, and we'll have to look into that. David, thanks a lot for the call and for the heads up. Susan in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, Susan, thanks for watching us on Dish Network on Free Speech TV. What's up?
Well, thank you for being there, Tom. I'll make it quick. I agree with you that the commons are important and that we need to take them back, number one. But we've not honored any treaty in history with the Indians. And are you suggesting that the commons should be given back to the Indians? And then the rest of us should have to actually honor the treaties and pay back to them what we stole from them?
I don't think it's practical. I think that we're at a point where we need to, certainly there needs to be some restitution. And there needs to be the equivalent of, you know, how do we help Native Americans in the way that they want to be helped have something other than a lifestyle of terrible poverty? I spent a few weeks working on one of the Navajo reservations in the Southwest, this is a reservation of 10,000 people. They had over 500 kids in foster care. They had a terrible problem with alcohol. They had a whole series of all these problems that were associated with poverty. We should be doing something about that. I'm totally in favor of that.
Correct.
On the other hand, to say, I'm going to come to your house because it used to be Potawatomi land and take it away and give it back to the Potawatomi, it ain't going to happen. And so there needs to be a certain, practical solution. I frankly don't know what it is, but I would love to start the conversation. I think America needs to have a conversation about it. Thank you for calling. Coming up tomorrow, we'll have a conversation with Senator Sherrod Brown, the Democrat from Ohio, about the important issues of the day. Plus, best of the rest of the news and your calls right here on the Tom Hartman Program. Occupying the media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. And don't forget, democracy begins with you. When you get out there and get active, tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.